I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. The civil war in Syria that has been raging for 3 years shows no sign that it's going to end anytime soon. It's estimated that 200,000 civilians have been killed and more than 2.5 million Syrians have fled, most to neighboring nations. The government forces of President Bashar al-Assad have been fighting competing rebel groups across the country. ISIS, that now controls large sections of Syria and Iraq and is an offshoot of al-Qaeda, grew out of the violence and chaos in Syria. Republicans use President Obama's strategy in Syria against Democrats running in the midterm elections. Our guest Reese Ehrlich joins us to unravel the roots of this conflict, the struggle for power, and the possible way forward. He's the author of a new book called Inside Syria, the backstory of their civil war and what the world can expect. He's speaking tonight at 7 o'clock at the George School in Newtown, Pennsylvania. Reese Ehrlich, it's been a long time. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much, Marty.
What's the most frustrating, even infuriating thing for you in watching, listening, reading about the American coverage of the war in Syria?
Well, I think, unfortunately, much of the mainstream media has given a pass on the latest war that we're now waging. First of all, it is a war. When you bomb people and you send in your own people as helicopter pilots, that's a war. It's not a counterinsurgency action or whatever else it might be, euphemism might be used. And ironically, I think that the U.S. bombing campaign now is going to strengthen the Islamic State, not weaken it, because now they are can claim they went from being a local group, which was certainly a great danger to the people of Syria and Iraq, to a worldwide fighter against U.S. imperialism and Zionism. Mm. And it will actually help recruit. And it's not they're not being militarily defeated. And even if the U.S. bombing were somehow successful, who's going to fight and take and hold the cities that are liberated? There's nobody in Iraq or Syria able to do that. So it's a losing – that's what's angry. That makes me angry.
Makes you angry. But are you saying and should we get used to the idea that ISIS could control large parts of Syria and Iraq and we just have to learn to live with it?
Well, not – obviously it's a horrible, evil group full of war criminals and engaging in horrific ethnic cleansing. And they're certainly a danger to the people of Iraq and Syria.
Indeed.
They're not any more of a danger to the people of the United States than al-Qaeda or some of these other groups. In other words, they don't have sleeper cells. They're not going to carry out organized terrorist attacks in the U.S. That's an important distinction because there's lots of very, very evil groups in the world. Boko Haram in Nigeria is an example, the kidnapping of those girls who are engaged in horrific things, but nobody's talking about bombing Nigeria. So in the case of the Islamic State, they are internally, I think they will implode over time. They can't rule with this harsh, phony version of Islam without generating rebellions from Sunni supposed supporters and Sunni tribal chiefs and so on. We're already seeing some examples of that. So with the U.S. not bombing would probably lead to its demise much quicker than the bombing will.
The idea that even under a sort of a terrorist state, if that's what we can call whatever ISIS controls, that people would rise up against this group?
I think they would.
And be able to defeat them, overthrow them, get rid of them?
Yeah, I think so. We've seen some examples of that happening already. People say, well, where are they going to get their weapons from? And the ISIS is so well armed. First of all, they're armed with U.S. weapons because they captured them. And they and similar extremist groups are capturing the weapons supplied to the so-called moderate rebels. So every step that the U.S. has taken to supposedly combat them has backfired. And it's not because Obama was weak-kneed or vacillated or something like that. It's because the U.S. policies in the region are unpopular with ordinary Syrian people. And yes, I think the Islamic State will be defeated internally.
Let me just pick up on what you said, because one of the arguments against what the president has been doing or perhaps not been doing is that a couple of years ago, if we had armed the moderate rebels, the Syrian Free Army, for instance, we wouldn't have seen the rise of ISIS. We wouldn't be in what, the third, almost fourth year of a civil war in Syria.
Well,
yes, no?
In reality, we'd be in even a worse situation than we are now.
You think so?
Yeah. The Obama administration tried creating pro-U.S. civilian coalition. They tried backing the Free Syrian Army. Your listeners may not know it, but roughly 2 weeks ago, the Pentagon announced they're no longer going to fund the Free Syrian Army. This is the group we've been sponsoring for 3 years. Why? Because they don't agree politically that the Islamic State is a worse enemy than Assad. They want to fight both the Islamic State and Assad, and that's not acceptable to the U.S., so they're cutting off the funding. And every time the U.S. has started to arm one of these groups, they significant numbers either defect over to the extremists or get their arms captured. And that just – it was this morning's New York Times had an article about exactly that, where the al-Nusra Front, which is the group affiliated with al-Qaeda, now took over arms from the U.S. that had been given to one of these moderate groups. So had they given more arms, there'd be more arms in the hands of the extremists.
But are you saying that there are no moderates in this fight, or that the shifting politics just means that people are changing sides and there aren't the sort of good guys over here and the bad guys over there?
Yeah, it's a little bit of both. In the beginning, the Muslim Brotherhood, which I describe as a center-right political Islam party, and secular progressives were the main forces making up the uprising in roughly the first year of 2011. And there was some opportunities there, but the U.S. didn't like the Muslim Brotherhood, and the Muslim Brotherhood didn't like the U.S. policies. And that's at the core of the problem. It's not how much arms we've sent, but the U.S. plans for Syria are at odds with what the Syrian people want. The U.S. says, we're going to bring democracy, we're going to bring free elections, free markets. And then the Syrians go, wait a minute, where have you done this successfully? Oh, yeah, Afghanistan. Oh, yeah, Iraq. Oh, yeah, your backing of everything that Israel does against the Palestinians. The Syrian popular opinion is at odds with U.S. policy, and that's at the core of the problem.
You described the Kurds, and there are Kurds in Syria, there are Kurds in Iraq, there are Kurds in Turkey, that they're the sort of wild card in this conflict. We've also been told that the Kurds in Iraq are the best friends America has in the Middle East. Do you agree with that?
Well, certainly there's widespread sentiment in Kurdistan and certainly among the leading parties there. They want to be staunch U.S. allies. They want more arms. They want to be independent. And there, once again, we have a slight rub, because so far the U.S. says Iraq should remain as one unified nation. The Kurds have publicly announced a referendum. They haven't set a date, but they want to hold a referendum on independence. And the very arms that the U.S. is now supplying to the Kurdish Peshmerga, their military, will be used against the Islamic State today and against the Iraqi army tomorrow when the independence fight breaks out. So that's why I call them a wild card. The U.S. oil companies are heavily involved in northern Iraq.
A lot of oil up there.
A lot of oil, ninth largest reserves in the world, according to Kurdish officials. And the oil companies, or at least some of them, would be very happy to see an independent Kurdistan with the leadership that's pro-oil.
I mean, some of the Kurds have called for creating their own country from not just Iraq, but also the Kurds in Syria, the Kurds in Turkey. Do you see that as a true vision?
Well, that's kind of a long-term aspiration, if you will, for most Kurds. The Kurdish people were artificially divided up back in after World War I by the British and French. They were promised self-determination in one of the treaties after World War I, and then that promise was reneged on. So there's certainly that sentiment. But in the real world, the leading Turkish parties of Kurds call for autonomy, and same in Syria. They're not calling for independence. The place where there's likely to be independence would be in Iraqi Kurdistan.
Let me ask you about a recent report from Human Rights Watch talking about ISIS, talking about the torture of boys that had been kidnapped and held. I mean, as all things related to ISIS and his treatment of the civilian population, it's just absolutely a horrifying read.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, so does the United States stand by while ISIS tortures little boys?
Well, it's horrible.
And, it is horrible.
And it is war criminal activity, and it's evil, and it's rational from their standpoint, because what they're seeking to do, they know they can't win over Kurds or Christians or Shia Muslims, so they engage in ethnic cleansing to kill or torture or drive out people from areas so that they can rule. So as evil as it is, there's an evil logic to it. Mm-hmm. And as I said before, they're a serious danger to the people of the region. But, you know, it was only a year ago when we had the chemical weapons scare. Remember? That was the crisis number 118. Now it's the Islamic State, and next week it'll be something else. And the U.S. you have to judge, is this crisis a humanitarian one for the people of the region, or is this something that's going to affect the people in the United States? Mm. Because we can't bomb Nigeria, even though there's horrible human rights going on, violations there, and various other parts of the world. You have to draw the line somewhere.
At the same time, I mean, just because we are focused on Syria, something like 2.5 million Syrians have fled to neighboring countries. There are millions who are dislocated within Syria itself. And again, you know, we have winter coming in Syria. I know it can be pretty harsh for people living in a refugee camp or out in an abandoned building somewhere.
No, absolutely. And I do advocate, I don't believe that U.S. should disengage from the region. I think diplomatically, economically, it can help with the refugee crisis, for example. There's plenty of aid that needs to be sent to Jordan, Turkey, Lebanon, and other countries who are receiving these refugees. Absolutely. There's also aid that should be brought through international agencies to the people of Syria who are being starved out by the policies of the Assad government. They lay siege to a city and prohibit arms, not just arms, but medicine, food, anything from getting in. And there can be international diplomatic efforts to break that. But that's different from sending in troops. The problem is if you somehow created a perfect world, the United States goes in, it bombs, it defeats the Islamic State, and then it goes home. After 6 months. But that doesn't work. That's not how the U.S. operates.
It doesn't seem to work in the Middle East.
It certainly doesn't work in the Middle East. What you're going to have is a creeping war that already costs $10 million a day, with money that we don't have for health care and education, and is going to cost more than that as the war continues. The pressure will be on to send U.S. troops because the local folks aren't doing it, and we can't lose. We've made a commitment now. What are you going to be, a traitor? You're going to be a wuss and turn around, and pretty soon you've got another occupation of Iraq and all the disaster that comes with that.
I mean, is that what you see as a scenario, or do you think there is something, and we're almost up in a break, your diplomatic solution?
Right now, I think the pressure is on for escalating the war. Now, I'm not predicting absolutely that that will happen. But if you're not winning, if you've made a military commitment and you're losing the war, the pressure is to do something to escalate. We saw that in Vietnam. We saw that in Iraq, Afghanistan. And we know the disastrous consequences.
Do you think it's pressure from Republicans or pressure within the Obama administration?
Hawks on both Democratic and Republican sides. Hillary Clinton and David Petraeus on one side. Lindsey Graham and John McCain on another. They're pretty much in unity that I think would be even more disastrous policies than we have now.
Well, let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation. Reese Ehrlich is our guest in this hour of Radio Times. He's been reporting from the Middle East for, decades now, and was in Syria about a year ago. It's a country he knows quite well. It's also the subject of his new book called Inside Syria, subtitled The Backstory of Their Civil War and What the World Can Expect. And our guest, Reese Ehrlich, speaking tonight at the George School at 7 p.m. That's in Newtown in Bucks County. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne talking with Reese Ehrlich. He's a freelance journalist, a special correspondent for Global Post, and again, author of a new book called Inside Syria, The Backstory of Their Civil War and What the World Can Expect. And yes, we know everyone else is talking about the midterm elections, the results of those elections last night. That's something we'll be talking about tomorrow on Ballot Talks on Radio Times. But we don't want to forget other important news and issues around the world, including what is going on in Syria. And again, that was also part of some of these midterm elections, certainly a criticism that Republicans used against President Obama. Again, you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Reese, we've been talking, and so much of the conversation is about ISIS, I think, for all the obvious reasons. But your book is also about all these other groups, these splinter groups that are either fighting each other, or sometimes they're on the same side and then they're on the other side, fighting the Assad, fighting the United States. I mean, this is just a sort of a cauldron of rebel groups.
Yeah, and that's what makes it so difficult for the U.S. to have a coherent policy. There's some 1,500 rebel groups, believe it or not.
1,500.
Yeah, exactly. And some of them range from just a few people from the same village or neighborhood in a city who've banded together. to groups that are better known, like the Free Syrian Army, the Al-Nusra Front, and the Islamic State, of course. So the problem is it's not a coherent political military strategy as we saw, for example, in Central America in the 80s or in Africa, in South Africa, just as one example. It's scattered groups who've united on opposing Assad, but not a whole lot else. And that's what it's going to take some sorting out. And right now, the extremist groups who use Islam as the excuse are in the ascendancy because they appear to be winning, and people tend to go towards the winning side. I don't think that will last, but that's the momentum at the moment.
So when you talk about 1,500 rebel groups in Syria, I mean, some just a village that might get together. I mean, is it that they see a power vacuum if Assad goes, or trying to control perhaps their portion of that country?
Sure, that's part of it, which is that it's so chaotic. If Assad controls it, it's very brutal repression, jailing, torture. If Assad is not in control, then who is? And there's not really a functioning government in most areas, just survival issues of getting medical care and food and income. It becomes primary, and you band together for self-defense to protect your neighborhood kind of thing. And then you might form an alliance with a neighboring group and then break that alliance later. It's quite complex.
You have interviewed President Assad.
Yes.
What's he like to interview?
I interviewed him in 2006, well before the uprising began. And he's on a personal level. He's personable. He's fluent in English. He was an ophthalmologist studying in London before he was called back to be groomed for the presidency. But on the substance of the issues, when I did the interview, I went around to as many Syrians as I could and asked them, what question would you ask your president? Huh. And I wrote them down. And the questions I raised were looking at the issues that concerned Syrians at the time. So Kurds were not allowed citizenship, a good 350,000 of them. There were no viable, fair elections. There were no opposition parties, opposition trade unions. So I asked all these questions, and his answer was, these are all plots by the United States.
Oh, really? I mean,
These are foreign concerns, and well, yes, there might be some legitimacy, but it's going to take several years to hold discussions before we can get to the possibility of even making changes. So those were all the issues that came up in the uprising of 2011. And he could have – it's not like he was unaware, but by ignoring those, he sealed his own fate.
He wasn't even supposed to be the president
of
Syria. It was really his brother who was killed in a car accident.
Yes, exactly.
Of some sort. So, yeah. I mean, is he maybe initially a reluctant president because it wasn't – he was thinking, I'll be an eye doctor instead?
Well, there was a period of time when he was called back, but his father was still in power. So he groomed him, and Hafez al-Assad, the father, died in 2000. And there was actually hope in the beginning that Bashar would make some reforms. He did release some political prisoners. Ironically enough, he implemented kind of pro-Western neoliberal economic policies, selling off state industries, allowing private sector to develop new industries, but he gave the properties to his cronies, family members and political supporters, so it was not all that helpful for ordinary people. And he cracked down and brutally repressed people, of course, when the uprising began in 2011. So whatever initial intentions of reform he may have had have long disappeared.
And his supporters are largely, what, Christians, Alawites, or a mixed bag?
Yeah. The key element of why he's been able to stay in power has been the military has not split. And the economic elite, the billionaire businessmen, are still largely behind him. In addition to that, he does have some support among various religious and ethnic minorities, Christians, Shia Muslims, Alawites, which are a separate Muslim faith, and they both are subject to propaganda from the government, but also see some of the extremist groups, and they say, you know, Assad may be no good, but at least he's better than these nutcase extremists that we see doing these horrible things. So he's managed to hold on to power in part of the country.
Well, we know when President Obama drew this line in the sand about, you know, if you use chemical weapons, we're going to do something about it. You raise questions about who else was using chemical weapons in Syria. Is there any question about Assad's military using chemical weapons?
Yeah, there is. I spent the better part of a chapter in my book looking exactly at this. We begin in March of 2013 when there was some low-level chemical attacks, including sarin. But they were attacks on Assad checkpoints. They weren't attacks on civilians. And there's credible evidence that I cite in my book that the al-Nusra Front, which at that time included both the Islamic State and the al-Nusra Front, had possession of chemical weapons that they had brought in from Turkey. And it's quite possible that they used it both as a way to attack Assad's troops and to provoke the United States into attacking Syria. There's some very credible evidence on that.
But are you saying that Assad has or had chemical weapons?
Oh, absolutely. So then we kind of fast forward a few months to August, which is the more famous incident where hundreds of people were killed. Two things to note. The U.S. version of events proved to be almost completely false. They overestimated the number of people killed. They didn't accurately portray where the missiles had been fired from. There were massive holes in the U.S. version of what happened. But the central question remains, the Assad government had accessible military chemical weapons, and the attack was on civilians in rebel-controlled areas, not on Assad's troops. So it tells you a lot who are the victims of the war. And it's certainly possible that Assad did use chemical weapons in that case. But at a minimum, it looks like both sides had used chemical weapons, something the U.S. has not been willing to admit.
But does that, you think, in part explain why President Obama didn't do the thing that he said he would do?
Exactly. So the first chemical attacks, and I've shortened this considerably because there were additional ones since March. If it turns out that the rebels had, in fact, used chemical weapons and the U.S. started bombing Assad for that reason, it would be pretty embarrassing. And I think that was what it wasn't a weak-kneed response or lack of resolve. I think they knew there was at least a credible possibility that rebels had done it and how embarrassing it would be to go to war for what your own side did, even if they were groups that the U.S. criticized.
And you have interviewed people, you know, within, what, the Pentagon, the State Department?
I have interviewed State Department folks. I have interviewed a lot of people inside Syria, a lot of chemical weapons experts. And you read that chapter and make your own judgments.
That's Reese Ehrlich, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. We're talking about Syria, a country he knows very well. He's also written a new book about it called Inside Syria, the backstory of their civil war and what the world can expect. I do want to get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Any questions or comments for our guest talking about this very volatile region of the world. Let me get Ernest from, looks like Allentown, to join our conversation. Hi, Ernest. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Good. I was just giving you a call because, I live in the Lehigh Valley, and there's a lot of Syrian Christians here that come from families that moved here, probably 100 years ago. I'm not too sure why they moved all at once. It probably had something to do with the Ottoman Empire, but there's many Syrian Christians here that have really interwoven in daily life, intermarried, and have done quite well in our capitalistic system. And the reason I'm giving you a call is there used to be a huge isolationist streak in the United States around World War II, and it seems to only exist now with libertarians.
Well,
so it seems like it's kind of been pretty much has been won over against. And, you know, I bounce around between the two sides because, you know, on one side, I think maybe we should just pull out of all this because our budget can't stand it. But then on the other side, I saw what happened in Afghanistan when the terrorists built camps and we were attacked. So how do we balance those two things.
Well, Ernest, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And I think a lot of people, Reese, you know, wonder, and you can't have a kind of one-size-fits-all foreign policy, but this swing between interventionist and isolationist.
Yeah, I don't think those are the two choices. I'm not an isolationist. I certainly believe the United States should be engaged internationally, but through diplomatic political means, not through military intervention. And that's the big difference. Certainly, people were outraged and justifiably so about the 9/11 attacks. But, you know, we invaded and occupied a country that had nothing to do with the 9/11 attacks other than the fact that Osama bin Laden had been living there. And he quickly fled. And meanwhile, the U.S. was engaged in a 10-year war of occupation, which we're now in the process of losing. And the same thing happened in Iraq. So at the time, it seems like military action will be the definitive and successful alternative. But if the U.S. Involves itself diplomatically, politically, actually pressures its allies and its opponents to reach a political settlement in Syria, in the long run, it's going to be far more effective than the military means.
Does that mean then, it's interesting when you see who's on whose side, that gets even more complicated, but we're on the same side as Saudi Arabia, for instance, and we have allies in the region. But does Saudi Arabia want what the United States wants in the Middle East or Syria?
Basically, no. Each of those countries has their own long-term goals and desires for what the U.S. should do, none of which correspond to the needs of the American people, in my view. So I reported from Saudi Arabia, for example, and they were backing the al-Nusra Front, the al-Qaeda affiliate, although they denied it, at a time when that included the Islamic State. And the irony, of course, is that the Saudis want a authoritarian government in power in Damascus that's pro-Saudi, and they have a very ultra-conservative view about religion and politics. They don't like elections. They don't like free speech, etc. And the U.S. is now going to send 5,000 so-called moderate rebels to Saudi Arabia for training. And that's a little bit like having the Chicago police cadets trained by Al Capone. You know, it's not going to happen. If the program ever kicks off, the people who come back are going to be inculcated with Saudi ultra-conservative views, not the U.S. ones. So ostensibly we're on the same side, but in reality there's two different sets of goals.
Is it helpful to think of not just Syria, but this whole region as a kind of long-simmering Sunni-Shia conflict?
No.
No? Short answer, no. And why not?
Because what this is about is the struggle for political and economic power. Let's not forget the oil in Iraq and Kurdistan. Let's not forget the strategic location of Syria, which is bordered on key countries in the region. That's what it's all about. And then both sides use religion to rally their troops. So it might appear from the outside that it's a Sunni versus Shia conflict. But in reality, it's geopolitics, it's economics.
I mean, when you say, it seems to me all countries are about power. You know, leaders want to maintain power. They want to protect their borders. Perhaps they want to invade another country. I mean, is there a certain kind of power that you associate with the Middle East?
No, it's the good old power.
Good old power would recognize
not
anywhere.
Not all you recognize it, whether it's in Washington or Baghdad. We often hear that Sunnis and Shias have been fighting each other for centuries, so why should we get involved and think we can make any difference? Well, they've also lived in peace for centuries. And you can selectively pick out whatever conflict you want and claim that characterizes it, or that somehow Islam is a warlike religion and what Christianity is peaceful, like the Crusades and World War I and II and every other war has been fought in the name of Christianity. Or abortion doctors are murdered in the name of Christianity. But we know that has nothing to do with actual Christian religion. So all these extremist groups claiming to be fighting in the name of Islam have nothing to do with Islam.
We have a question from Murad saying, did the role that the U.S. played in trying to redraw the greater Middle East contribute to the current situation? And I guess that has to do with Iraq and some of these other conflicts in the Middle East.
Yes, it goes back even further than that to World War I,
right? Which is sort of where your book starts.
Yes, my assumption is that most Americans know nothing about Middle East history, and if they do, it's from watching reruns of Lawrence of Arabia. So I use that as the premise and try to explain the characters in the book and who were the real ones and so on. And of course, the British and the French promised self-determination to the Kurds, to the Arabs, and to the Jews, and reneged on the promises to everybody after World War I, and drew artificial lines, which are the source of a lot of the problems today. Not all of them, but many. And yes, the U.S., when it created a no-fly zone after the first Gulf War in 1991,
In the north and south.
You basically created two – you already had split Iraq into two areas, although without a formal division of the country. And today the Iraqi Kurdistan functions like an independent government for all intents and purposes. It's got its own embassy or consulates abroad. It negotiates oil contracts with companies. It has its own pipelines and its own military, et cetera. So – the U.S., in the effort to defeat Saddam Hussein, it laid the basis for what we're seeing today. And, of course, there were no Islamic extremist groups in Iraq prior to the U.S. invasion. They arose as a direct result of the opposition to the U.S. occupation.
Almost up on a second break here. So what do you think of the new government in Iraq?
In Baghdad. Well, the current prime minister comes from the same party as al-Maliki. They have very close ties with Iran. The U.S. is hopeful that they will have different policies, but so far there's been no indications. The key question was how do you build an alliance with both the Kurds and the Sunni Muslims in Iraq so that they will fight against the Islamic State, particularly the Sunnis. And that involves real serious political changes. And so far the Iraqi Shia militia have been sent into battle who then proceed to exterminate the Sunnis and engage in their own ethnic cleansing. Again, as shown in today's article in the New York Times. So far, it's not a good sign.
That's Reed Ehrlich, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. We're talking about Syria and the Middle East. And again, his book is called Inside Syria. And he is a special correspondent for Global Post. And we are talking about the Middle East. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Bryant University supports WHYY. Bryant University, with more than 150 years of preparing students with the knowledge, skills, and qualities of character for success in a changing world. Information on undergraduate and graduate programs at success.bryant.edu.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Reese Ehrlich. And if you think the civil war in Syria is just a matter of good guys against bad guys, you would be wrong. Our guest has talked with rebels, with civilians, government leaders, including the Syrian president back in 2006 for his reporting over the years and also for his new book called Inside Syria. And again, we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, Radio Times at WHYY.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. In fact, we have an email from Beth. She says, is it also a resource problem? I heard some rebels were fighting because of water issues.
Yes. I mentioned oil, but water is a close second. To take a step back, the Syrian uprising began in part because of a severe drought that was taking place in Syria. It forced a lot of farmers off the land into the cities. They were unemployed. There were no efforts to find them jobs, and that was a contributing factor. And who controls the water in the region has a big impact on who controls the region.
Right. You mentioned oil, and other people do as well. And I heard on NPR last night that the United States is now the number one producer of oil in the world. How much do you think that either has changed or will change U.S. policy in the Middle East?
I don't think it'll really change it because the oil industry looks 10, 20, 50 years down the line. And yes, the U.S. is producing because of shale oil production, is producing a lot more now than it has in the past. Although at one time it was number one oil producer back in the teens of the 1900s, actually. But the folks in Washington and the think tanks and the policy makers look long-term, and of course the oil companies themselves look long-term, and Iraq has the third largest oil reserves in the world. Kurdistan has the ninth. Iran has the second. Saudi Arabia has the first. So you total them up, and who controls the oil who controls those countries has a big impact internationally as well, even though the U.S. does get its oil from other places as well, for example, Venezuela and elsewhere.
You mentioned the movie Lawrence Arabia. I remember it well. I've seen it a number of times. So when
I would hum the theme song now,
but I could do it with you. So how do people in Syria or in, you know, where this story took place, mm-hmm. how do they see Lawrence of Arabia?
Oh, that was fascinating because I had a sense of that for the United States, but I really didn't know for the Middle East. And right. It turns out that most people had never heard of Lawrence Arabia except from the film.
True. So they,
because he was in real life, while he's this bigger than life character in our imaginations and numerous books written about him, in real life he was a relatively minor military attaché attached to the Arab irregulars. And the Arabs themselves were a quite effective fighting force. And he played a political role of trying to win over certain of the monarchs and the traditional families to support British rule after the collapse of the Ottomans. And so he, along with the other British, promised independence and then reneged on it immediately after the war. And the scene in Lawrence of Arabia that struck me the most was when, towards the very end of the film, the Arabs have taken over Damascus and they can't run the electric company, they can't run the water supply, and so they leave as kind of these uncivilized rebels who can't govern themselves. In reality, they had taken over Damascus, the Arab forces. They were running it fine. They used the old technicians from the Ottoman Empire, and it was the British and the French who seized it back from the independent Arab forces.
What I get from your book is that we need to understand this history and especially the impact of colonial powers on the Middle East if we're going to understand some of the conflicts and players today.
Absolutely. And the French, of course, controlled what is now Lebanon and Syria and a southern slice of Turkey. And the British controlled what is today Palestine, mm-hmm. Israel, Saudi Arabia, and so on, Jordan, and Iraq. So and of course, even back then, the role of oil was critical. The city of Kirkuk was the first oil discoveries in the Arab world, 1927. And it's been a bone of contention ever since. So even today, now the Kurds claim it as their capital and occupy Kirkuk. The Baghdad government claims it as their own. It's not about geography. It's about the oil.
Hmm. Back to the question about chemical weapons. Yeah. Mike from Wilmington says Obama never said what he would do in response to the use of chemical weapons, although it's clear he was trying to minimize our involvement. Is it reasonable to conclude that he accomplished his objective when the threat of U.S. involvement caused Putin to convince Assad to divest himself of the chemical weapons?
That was the Hail Mary pass that worked. In other words, they had absolutely no plans to do that. When it became clear that there was no support for bombing Assad back at that time, a year ago. Yes, and I think that was a good thing.
And a good thing, right?
I'm glad that Assad has destroyed the chemical weapons. That was positive for everybody in the region.
Let me get to it. Looks like Fee from Sharon Hill to join our conversation. Hi, Fee. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
To the comments about we can't keep getting involved with international conflicts as they arise year after year, whether it's chemical weapons or internal conflicts. You know, this faction, we can't forget that this faction beheaded our citizens publicly. And I know we're dependent on the oil. I know we're dependent on that region being successful because of our dependency to the oil. But from a non-retaliatory perspective about these poor people losing their lives. I mean, I didn't know the first thing about them until they lost their lives. But how do we not get involved based on what we're seeing happen to our citizens overseas?
Fee, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Yeah, go ahead, Reese.
Well, of course, it was a horrible tragedy. As a freelancer, I felt it particularly strongly because that could have been me.
Sure.
And we have to keep it in context as those attacks, those beheadings took place after the U.S. started the bombing.
Do you think they're connected?
Oh, of course. I think the Islamic State said, you're going to bomb us, we're going to kill your citizens. Now, that's perverse. It's illegal. It's a horrific war crime. But again, it's perverse logic from their standpoint.
And that's who we're dealing with, obviously.
And that's who we're dealing with. You know, there are other U.S. citizens in captivity now, both by rebel groups and by governments in Iran, for example. Every time an American is threatened with death or imprisonment or horrible things, we can't go to war over it. I think it was the incident that's changed public opinion, and the White House made full use of that.
Fee, thanks for the call to Radio Times. I mean, these are very emotional issues, and we should say that, yes, these were horrible decapitations.
Absolutely. I had tried – James Foley was a Global Post freelancer, and I tried in a small way to help release him when on a trip to Syria unsuccessfully. I feel it deeply, the issue. But there's a difference between that kind of – I mean – the people who perpetrated should be punished as criminals, not as part of a war.
Mm. And it should also be said that, I mean, what they're also doing to the civilian population on a more daily or weekly basis.
Far worse than anything they've done to the Americans, as we've seen by these most recent human rights reports.
Fee, thanks for the call. Let me see what Jill from, looks like Wynwood, has to say. Hi, Jill. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Can you hear me?
Yes, and hey, go ahead.
This is Joe from
Joe, Wynmore. I'm sorry, Joe.
That's okay. I was wondering what your guest thinks. Who does Israel want to see prevail in this conflict?
Good question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Israel initially, along with the U.S., when the uprising first began in Syria, was suspicious of the rebels and was willing to continue working with the devil they knew. That is, they didn't particularly like Assad, but he had kept the Israeli border quiet along the Golan Heights and was not, you know, had a strong dictatorship that was predictable.
Right.
When it became clear that he was losing support and they thought he would be overthrown, then Israel, along with the U.S., threw its support behind groups like the Free Syrian Army. And that's who the Israelis are backing today. But it's quiet because if they were to publicly announce who they were backing, both sides would get mad at them.
You say another way to think about this is a proxy war between Iran and Russia. I guess on one side, the U.S., Gulf states, some NATO countries on the other side?
Yes. I think what began as a genuine popular uprising became more and more involved with outside pressure, and that's exactly it. So you have the U.S., Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and other allies on the one side, Iran, Russia on the other. And so far, I mean, the Assad government thought it was doing a lot better than it really is. It only controls about a third of the country, which is not much. But the rest of the country is fragmented among various rebel groups. So right now it's a stalemate, and all sides are pouring in weapons and advisors.
Joe, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well, 1-888-477-9499. Talking with Reese Ehrlich about Syria and the Middle East, a hotbed of competing conflicts and some deep history as well. And again, 1-888-477-9499. So how does this end? I mean, is there a conclusion to – I'm talking about Syria now. What is it, a three-year civil war?
At this point in the conversation, most people are going, I'm really depressed.
Well, I was going to – I'm thinking that. I was trying to give it the benefit of the doubt.
To use an old 60s expression, I'm really bummed out.
Well, but you end your book, People Will Prevail.
That's right.
I mean,
I am optimistic. Okay. I really am, and even in a very difficult situation. In the short run, I think we got a lot of problems because the U.S. Is just at the top of the slippery slope. I think it's going to be more involved, and I think it's going to mean more dangerous for people in the U.S. and in the region. However, in the medium and the long run, the Islamic State, I don't think, will be able to govern. Their policies are too harsh. They will provoke internal rebellions. And I think we do have some examples in the region of people resolving things themselves without outside interference. So Tunisia just had free elections. The Islamist Party gave up power to a coalition of left and parties and individuals from the old regime. The trade union movement is quite vibrant. The women's movement is quite vibrant.
This
so there's a lot of hopeful signs in Tunisia, and I think those lessons can work in other places as well.
But they're not working in Libya. They're not working.
Nope.
I mean, they're not working in almost every other country that had their Arab Spring. It's not working.
Yeah. And in some cases, the Arab Spring uprisings are continuing, like in Bahrain, for example, and some parts of Saudi Arabia. No, that's true. But the question is there something the U.S. should be doing militarily to change that? Or does that make it worse?
Right.
And that, I think, is the answer is no, the U.S. Should not be engaged militarily. And, you know, if we remember back the Lebanon Civil War from 1975 to 2000 was 15 years, was a horrible war at the time. Christians and Muslims fighting each other and kidnappings and torture. It was horrible. But eventually the Lebanese themselves resolved it. They had a peace treaty. The Syrian troops were eventually forced to get out. Lebanon is stable.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not claiming it's a model or anything like that, but you can resolve issues. People can resolve issues themselves given enough time.
We, though, as you well know, I mean, live in a world where there's instant news all the time. I mean, you know, you can pretend not to know what's going on in the world, but it's there for you to know about. And again, I think it's just one of these moral dilemmas about and I hear what you're saying about the downside of any kind of military involvement, but to sit on the sidelines also raises some not just moral questions, but also strategic questions as well.
Right. Well, my argument is it's not a question of sitting on the sidelines. It's a question of not intervening militarily. So if we could, for example, convince Turkey and Saudi Arabia and other U.S. allies not to be intervening, particularly on the sides of these extremist groups, we could go to Russia and Iran and say, look, we've stopped our intervention. You have no more excuse for your intervention. The people of Syria have to resolve this on their own. And I think that's actually realistic. I think that could work. And at the same time, we should all join together to help the refugees and help internally displaced people inside Syria and lay the basis for a political settlement. Because ultimately, it has to be settled politically. It's not going to be won militarily.
Because wars aren't won militarily anymore.
Exactly, especially these kinds of wars.
But if it's a proxy war and everyone sort of wants a piece of what's going on or has some skin in the game, are they going to sit around a table and say, okay, we're going to resolve this?
Not at the moment. The danger, of course, is that if the U.S. were somehow to stop its military intervention, Turkey and Saudi Arabia would step up theirs and Iran would step up theirs. Mm-hmm. Of course, it's the old vacuum theory, which is if we're not there, somebody else will do it.
Right.
But that's why I'm actually an advocate of engagement in the region diplomatically and politically to prevent exactly that sort of thing from happening.
So if you were to advise the president, you'd say stop the bombing campaign?
I certainly would.
And I realize that there are boots on the ground, but yeah, in certain parts of the...
And for sure resist the pressure to send more boots on the ground. That's the single biggest danger right now, because if the U.S. does... they won't send in combat. They won't call them that. They'll call them enhanced advisors, or they'll come up with some new euphemism to we have to send them out with the troops because the Iraqi troops aren't doing it on their own. And then some of them are going to get shot. And then you got to send in more to protect them. And pretty soon you've got military, much higher level of military engagement and a new occupation.
And you're saying the players can resolve this for themselves. Maybe not tomorrow.
That's right.
But in
time.
In time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, on that note, Rees Erlich, thank you very much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you. Can I mention that I am at Rees Erlich on Twitter?
You can.
And I also have a Facebook thing going too. I'm right up to the 19th century.
There you go. And we do as well. We're doing competing social media here. You can check us out at Radiotimes at WHYY.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Rees Erlich, our guest, his book is called Inside Syria, The Backstory of Their Civil War and What the World Can Expect. He's speaking tonight at 7 at the George School in Newtown in Bucks County, just outside of Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thanks so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back.